So I don't want to just get up here and start talking without doing a little bit of a game first. So I'm going to do a little game with you, if that's okay. Some of you look like you're still asleep a little bit. I'm also staring out there. I'm seeing some deer in headlight looks. I don't know if you know what I mean by that, but basically deer, like if you shine. I don't know. Like, again, some of you, most of you aren't from Pennsylvania. I don't know if you know a lot about Pennsylvania, but in Pennsylvania, the easiest way to describe it is Pittsburgh on one side, Philadelphia on the other, Alabama in the middle. Okay, and we live in the deep south of Alabama, okay? And what happens is that these guys, every fall, do this sport, right, called deer spotting. So basically what happens, you get a couple of, like, good old boys, you know, wearing their camo and stuff, and they get in their pickup truck, and they drive in these, like, windy country up and down roads at, like, 5 miles an hour, okay? It's like a 55-mile-an-hour road. They're going five, right? And they're just, like, going real slow, and they're shining, like, a giant spotlight on the fields. And they're just like, hey, man. We're going to find ourselves a deer. It's going to be so awesome. It's going to be so cool. And they're just, that's what they're doing. And they're like trying to like risk death because people come flying over the hills and you got to slam on your brakes. And what happens, they just drive along until they see a deer. And all of a sudden they see a deer and they're like, ah, man, it's a deer. Ah. And the deer's just sitting there eating, you know, like in the fields. And all of a sudden the light shines and the deer's like. Like that. That's what some of you look like. No offense, okay? Some of you look like zombies wondering if my brains are delicious. I'm sure they are because they're so amazing, but we're not going to test that theory, okay? So what I want to do is I want to do a little game that's going to do a couple things. One, it's going to help wake up a little bit. If you're still sore from sleeping on those comfortable beds in the cabins. Number two, it's going to help me to see how well you listen, which most of you are pretty good. Some of you are not so good. And number three, it's going to help me to see how smart you are, okay? Now, I'm going to say that my experience doing this game with teenagers is that you're going to stink at it. I'm just going to throw that out there right from the beginning. I like to do that. There's always like one person just looking at me like, bring it on. Okay. So, I know, like, all right, girlfriend. So, yeah, I know. I'm like the coolest person you'll meet today. It's okay. All right. So, so how many people as a kid ever played Simon Says? All right. We're not going to play that. I don't like Simon Says because my name's not Simon. And then what happens, I'm trying to get you out and then I get confused and I'm out. It's really embarrassing. So instead, we're going to play a version of Simon Says that I invented. Okay. It's called Scott Says. And basically, in case you grew up in a bubble or a foreign country and you never played Simon Says or Scott Says, here's the rules real quick. Basically, what's going to happen is when we start, I'm going to say a series of things to do or not to do. If I say Scott Says first, you do them, or don't do them, then you're in. If I don't say Scott Says first, you do them, don't do them, then you're out. Any questions? Any questions? Questions. That was the whole homily. It's all about questions. Okay. So, and by the way, side note, I was like so thrilled. How many people knew that Deacon Randy was talking about To Kill a Mockingbird when he said, who's Boo Radley? That makes me so happy. That's my favorite book ever. Like, I read it every year. And so when he, like, mentioned that, I was like, yes! I almost shouted out an amen, but that wasn't really Catholic. So anyway, okay, so we're going to play this game, and we'll see how good. Some people want me to say those directions again, but I only got one good one of those in me a day. If I tried to repeat it, my head would probably explode. Now, you might say to yourself, well, that would be entertaining, and that would be, like, awesome. I'd never forget this fest. That's true, but you'd probably need therapy for the rest of your life. So we're going to test that theory, all right? So that being said, all right, we're going to start. Everybody stand up. Come on, let's go. All right, awesome. If you stood up, you're out. Thanks for playing. You can have a seat. All right. You're out. And then you had all the smart people. So it looked like I got about half of you out. I'm sure some people were like not even paying attention. But if you're still in, can you raise your hand so I can see who's still playing? Okay, now you're out. Thanks for playing. All right. So now I got just about everybody. I hope I got the people that are like, he didn't say Scott said. Okay. So, you know, don't help people. This is like everybody for themselves. There's actually, you know, like potentially a prize for this game. All right. So, because I'm just feeling nice and we're running behind schedule anyway, I'm going to just say, Scott says everybody's back in. Okay. So we can all try again. All right. So, all right, we're going to start. Everybody stand up. Okay. Now, right there, we had a couple of minor flinches. Not sure if you could see. Okay. But there's a difference between a minor flinch and a major flinch. So you're sitting there and I said, you know, stand up. And some of you were like, like that. Right. And then you tried to be all cool about it. Like, oh, no, I didn't do that. I always do that. No, you don't. If you're sitting there and you're like, you need like therapy or something, right? Like nobody just does that, right? And girls, those are the guys that like you got to watch out for, right? Because like they like ask you on a date and they take you to the movies, right? And you're sitting in the movie theater and you're just like halfway through the movie and all of a sudden they're like, oh, how you doing? Okay, and it's a little awkward. They try that little sneaky move thing. Okay, so You'd be like, ain't nobody got time for that. Okay. So, all right. So we're going to start. Everybody stand up. All right, good. Everybody's getting warmed up. Scott says stand up. There's a little bit of hesitation on some people's part. I don't know if you're still asleep or if you, like, I'm really in your brain at that point, okay? Now, obviously, I have to hold a microphone, so if I say to do things with your arms, like if I say, put your arms up or whatever and then put them down or something like that, I'm saying arms, that's plural. Like, if I tried to do it, though, I'm going to go like this, and it gets really, really annoying because you can only hear part of what I'm saying, and it's, like, really annoying, and you're like, I want to break somebody in. Grace, what's wrong with all the sound system? What's going on? Okay. So I'm actually just going to be doing one arm, but if I do like arms, that means I want you to do two arms. You just don't do it like that. Okay. Cause that would be annoying. All right. So here we go. Scott says, put your arms up. Scott says, put your arms down. Scott says, put your arms up. Scott says, put your arms down. Put them up. You're out. Okay. If your arms went up, you're out. All right. Don't cheat. Jesus is watching. Okay. Seriously. Can you imagine you go to confession this week and you're like, forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. I cheated at a kindergarten game at Murad's Inn. He's going to be like, that's the dumbest sin I've ever heard of, okay? There's bad sin, really bad sin, and just dumb sin, okay? And the thing is true, if you're not good at this game, it's okay, right? Jesus still loves you, okay? It's true. And most likely, so does your mom, okay? Now, I say most likely because I don't know your mom, okay? If you go home, like, at lunch to the, like, fun little creepy cabins, right, and you're just like, hi, everybody, and you're all like, you have, like, when my family comes here, we have, like, this much room in the cabin. We're all together. We're like, hi, I'm going to go change, and you have to, like, go through this, like, mound of people to get into the room to change. Anyway, so if you're sitting there and your mom's like, so, how was the morning? And you're like, best day of my life. Heard the best speaker I've ever heard in my life. And then, like, she's like, wow, that's great. But then you remember this moment now, and you're like, but Mom, we played this game called Scott Says, and I'm really, really bad at it, okay? Now, if your mom looks at you at that moment and she's like, out of my house, demon child, right? Like, you probably need some family therapy. Most likely, she's going to be like, you know what, sweetie? That's okay. You're just not good at games like that. It's okay. Have a cookie, okay? And then you'll feel better, all right? All right. I know, moms are just great. They give cookies. It's awesome. Okay. All right, so let's try again. All right, Scott said put your arms up. Scott said put your arms down. Scott said put your arms up. Scott said put your arms down. Put Scott's put. Gotcha. Just kidding. I was just messing with you on that one. I'm just getting in your brain. Scott said put your arms up. Put them down. You're out. Now, if you're just like, oh, raise the roof, you're still in. Minor flinch, okay? All right, Scott says put them down. All right, put them up. Okay, if you put your arms up, like, right there, not only you're out, but you're probably going to go to prison someday, okay? Just saying, because I use my policeman voice, and you're like, ah! Okay. All right, Scott says put your arms out. Okay, that's going to be a little problem. Scott says put your arms down. If you're right next to someone, just spread out a little bit so you're not going to, like, punch him in the face. That would be awkward. If you moved, you're out. Okay, you can have a seat. Yep, thanks for playing. All right, Scott says if you're next to someone, just move, spread out a little bit so you don't punch him in the face. All right, there you go. All right, Scott says put your arms out. Scott says, make slow little circles. Okay. Shh, no, no, slow. Scott says, slow. Slow. Shh. Shh. Don't be so aggressive. Shh. 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 Just feel it. This is one of my happy places. Let's just sit here for a minute. You want to get the full effect? Just close your eyes. Take a deep breath. Doesn't that feel good? If you did that, you're out and a weirdo. Complete weirdo. Sit down. I heard people doing it. I heard your deep breath. It was awkward. Scott says, go faster. Scott says, go faster. Scott says, go faster. Feel the burn. Don't meet Sanders. All right. Good. All right. Stop. You're out if you stop. All right. Scott says, stop. All right. Put your arms down. You're out. Bam. Look at all the arms went down on that one. Bam. This guy over here, he's like, no, I'm Jesus. Okay. He's like, I will not move. Oh. Is your name Silento? Okay, look at me, look at me. All right, Scott says, put your arms down. All right, we're going to go kind of fast here. Scott says, touch your toes. Scott says, touch your knees. Scott says, touch your toes. Scott says, touch your knees. Scott says, touch your toes. Touch your knees. You're out. You're touching your knees. There we go. All right, Scott says, touch your waist. What's the problem?
The problem is, what if, like, I cannot touch my toes like this?
Yes, then you're out. Okay. That I used to have that problem too, but, you know, I've been working on it, and now I can touch my toes, okay? Okay, you just got to stretch out them back muscles a little bit, all right? All right, Scott, just touch your waist, okay? Scott, just touch your chin. Scott, just touch your waist. Scott, just touch your chin. Scott, just touch your waist. Scott, just touch your chin. Scott, just touch your waist. Scott, just touch your chin. If you're touching your nose, you're out. If you're touching your waist, you're out. If you're just like, I don't really know what I'm doing, you're out, which would be basically you guys. Because, dude, you were just like, you're out. Sit down, Franciscan University. Okay. All right. All right. Here we go. All right, so it's got to touch your head, it's got to touch your nose, it's got to touch your face. See, you can touch your face anywhere. So if you're still touching your nose, you're still in. All right. So guys, put your hands down. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are our 5 finalists. Oh, 6. Sorry, I forgot. You're sitting over there in like the – there's a like creepy section in the Muppets where the old guys sit up in the thing. That's like you. And he like keeps making comments. Like, see? It's like the – okay, so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. These are our 6 finalists. Everybody give me a hand. Come on down here right here. Hurry up. Hurry up. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. Okay, you're both out. Have a seat. Oh, sorry. Give them a hand. That's like the worst one ever. They're like, I'm a finalist. I'm a loser. Okay. All right. All right. So these are the 4 real finalists. All right. Scott says, come on down. Everybody give him a hand. All right. Come on down. All right. Scott says, line up here. Scott says, face the audience. Okay. All right. There you go. Scott says, you have to look straight ahead. Scott says you can't look up, can't look down, can't look side to side. You got to look straight ahead, okay? Scott says you have to keep your eyes open, but you are allowed to blink, okay? Because we don't want your eyeballs drying out and popping out of your face. That would be gross, okay? Scott says I'm going to count backwards from 10 to 0. Scott says when I get to 0, you are not allowed to smile or laugh for 60 seconds, okay? 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. She's quivering. You're out. You're smiling already. Mark's like, I'm so popular and people love me and I get shout outs. This is what? What are you doing? Oh, I'm gonna. You're laughing. You're out. See, what was gone over here, I was listening to those question and answers, and I was like here last fest too. That's a smile. And I was like thinking to myself, this is great. Like, this is like this, like, Marad's Inn, like, dating service or something. All the shout outs, like, I'm so beautiful. I don't know what to do with myself. And then he's like, I love Mark. I love whatever. Everybody's so special. All right, Mark, good try. You're out. All right, have a seat. Give it up for Mark. He was the last one standing. Mark, can you throw me the spirit? Throw me the spirit. Throw me the spirit. Whew, I just caught the spirit. Sorry. I love making fun of people's shirts. They don't know what I'm talking about. They think I'm a big weirdo, and then they don't realize like what they have written on their shirt is catch the spirit on the back. So I'm like, okay, that's what I want to do. So anyway, all right. I was really excited when Deacon Randy was asking all those questions in Mass today, because like it's so cool, because what I want to talk about today is actually a question, right? And I loved how he talked about all these questions that are in the scriptures and all these questions that Jesus asks us, right? And how Jesus uses questions to get us to think about deeper things. That's so cool, because Jesus already knows the answers to the questions, right? Especially when he asks us about ourselves, because he knows us better than we know ourselves. And it was just making me think a little bit about what I was going to share this morning. And when Teresa Schmitz contacted me and asked me, like, hey, would you come and talk at some of the fests this summer? And we started talking about like what I could talk about. I immediately thought of my testimony, because, you know, who doesn't like to talk about themselves? So I was like, yeah, I'll come talk about myself. But then, you know, on second thought, when you think about someone giving a testimony, they're not really talking about themselves, right? Normally in a testimony, you're not like talking about like the greatest things of your life. You're talking about the things that aren't so great in your life. And what you're really talking about is you're talking about God. So a testimony is something that you're giving in order to really give glory to God. It kind of like, basically I'm just a putz, right? And here's how God is so awesome despite the fact that I'm a putz, is basically what it comes down to. But it's really important. Like, if you guys don't I don't know how many of you are here for the first time. I don't know how many of you have been coming since like before you were even born to this fest. I don't know if you're just like, I love this and I come every year, or if you're just like, my parents dragged me and I didn't even want to come to this place and it seems kind of creepy. It's only like a couple days in and it seems kind of weird and I don't still understand what's going on. I don't really know. But the reality is if you're sitting here and you've ever been touched by God in a very deep or personal way, and maybe you haven't, maybe this week will be the week that that God does that for you. Maybe this is the week you'll be open to God touching you in a deep personal way, okay? And I pray that if you haven't been touched by God in a personal way, that this week will be that time that you are touched in a personal way by God. But if you have been touched by God, I really want to encourage you to to like have in your mind like a testimony for yourself. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, 45 minutes long with a PowerPoint presentation. That would be awkward to do, you know, whip that out in an elevator or on your school bus with somebody like, hey, you want to know about Jesus? Let me show you my life. You know, this is me when I was like two, you know, like that would be a little awkward. Okay. So maybe you're not going to have the chance to get up and go around the country and share your larger testimony with a bunch of young people all over the country like I get to do, but maybe you're going to be just on the school bus. Or you're going to be after a soccer game hanging out with some friends, or you're going to be in the cafeteria, or you're going to be in one of those times where you like you have friends over and it's like late at night and everybody's been goofy, and then you start getting tired, and then you start getting more goofy, and then all of a sudden, you know that part where it goes and it's like super serious, and you're like, whoa, when did this happen? And you're like, because it's 3 a.m., all right? And all the goofiness is gone, and all of a sudden somebody like brings up something super serious, and all of a sudden you're having this the most serious conversation you've ever had with your friends, and you didn't even know that was going to happen, and it just came out of nowhere. That's the times when you need to have some kind of a testimony, right? Because a lot of the questions that were asked, you know, were good questions, these theological questions, these kind of things like definitions of things or whatever, and it's good to know about our faith. But the reality is that if you start to just answer those kind of questions that people have, like you're some kind of a walking, breathing Catholic dictionary, okay? The problem with that is any of those answers, people can just argue with you about that, right? You can be like, well, Mary is sinless and she is the mother of Jesus. No, she's not. Okay. And then like all of a sudden you're arguing and someone can pull out scripture and say like, Jesus said that everyone sinned and falls short of the glory of God. But how come Mary isn't? You Catholics are wrong. You're a bunch of weirdos. I mean, and then you get into this debate. Okay. But if you look at someone and you're like, I love Mary. She's my mom. They might think you're a weirdo, but they can't argue with that. They can be like, no, you don't. Well, no. Yeah, actually I do. I love Mary. No, you don't. How can you tell me I don't love Mary? You don't love Mary. Okay, wow. Dude, take a chill pill, right? Like, so a testimony is more like how God has personally touched you. You know, maybe someone can argue with the definition of transubstantiation. You know, you can get into it with a Protestant about John chapter 6 and if Jesus really meant what he said about the Eucharist. But if you look at someone and you're like, I don't know all the answers and I don't know all the definitions, but when I'm at Mass or I'm at adoration, I know that I know that I know that that's Jesus. And God has completely touched my heart and spoken to me in ways I could have never imagined when I'm before him in the Eucharist. Well, someone, again, might be like, weirdo. But they can't be like, no, he didn't. Right? Like, you can't argue with somebody's testimony. You can think they're weird or stupid or dumb or whatever, but you can't argue with it. And I think right now, this is what Pope Francis is trying to get us to do. He's trying to remind us that the new evangelization is simply about sharing your heart with other people. That's what it's about, right? St. John Bosco once said, people won't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So when you're in a relationship with people and you're walking with people and you're accompanying people, and then they start to ask questions, again, you don't start with like, well, here's all the definitions that I learned when I was in eighth grade. I mean, you start with, here's what God has done in my life. Here's how God helped me through a difficult time. Here's how God helped me when everything in my life was falling apart. So, you know, again, I share this a little bit to kind of encourage you to kind of have your own testimony to get that, and also to just give glory to God. So we're gonna see if these will work. So I'm gonna start at the very beginning. Oh, good, it's working. Well, I'm not gonna start at the very beginning. That would be awkward. Okay. Thank you for getting that. I appreciate that. Okay. Other people are like, are you allowed to joke like that at Catholic Family Land? Okay. None of you would be here if it wasn't for that. Okay. So, 1971. I was born in 1971, but this was a photo of me when I was about 8 months old. Okay. And I know you're thinking, wow, you are a really cute baby. I know. I believe I was objectively cute, okay? Every baby is subjectively cute. Not every baby is objectively cute, okay? I mean, babies are beautiful, but sometimes, you know, you get a mom, and every mom's like, look at my baby. Isn't it the cutest baby you've ever seen in the world? And sometimes you're like, yeah, dang, that is a cute baby. Other times you're kind of thinking, looks like E.T., you know? But, moms still love their own babies, but they're not all objectively cute. But I don't just put this picture up there because I was objectively cute. And I know some of you might be thinking, well, geez, dude, what happened between then and now? I'm not really sure, but I'm sure that pizza and Twinkies had a lot to do with it, okay? So I'm looking at that picture, though, and I put that up there not because I think I was an objectively cute baby, but I also put that picture up there because it's a little bit of a miracle, okay? Not even just a little miracle. It's a big miracle that that picture is even taken, okay? When my mom was pregnant with me, she took this drug, okay? And it was a legal drug, okay? She was like, oh, your mom went. No, no. My mom took this legal drug, and it was legal. It had been developed in the late 60s and the early 70s, and it was given to women when they were pregnant, and it was an anti-nausea medication. So the idea behind this medication is that it would help women not be so sick. I'm sure some of you have seen your moms when they're pregnant. If you have younger brothers and sisters, and sometimes when women get pregnant, they have a little bit of morning sickness and nausea, and sometimes they're really, really sick, right? So this drug was like, everybody's like, oh yeah, this is a great drug because, you know, women can be pregnant and they're not going to be as sick. So why is that not a good thing? That's a great thing. If women can be pregnant and not be so sick, that would be awesome. The problem is that they didn't find out for a few years is that this drug started causing birth defects in women, right? And they didn't know at first that the drug itself was causing the birth defects. Right? They started to do some studies. They started to collect data. They realized, okay, there might be cause and effect here. They started taking it off the market, and then the birth defects all stopped, okay? In fact, some of you might have heard of Tony Melendez. He's a Catholic singer, plays the guitar. He plays it with his feet. You ever seen the guy on YouTube or playing the guitar with his feet? He's originally from Nicaragua. He actually, his mom took the same anti-nausea medication my mom did. And his birth defect is he was born without arms, right? So he has no arms, and he learned to play the guitar with his feet. He's actually pretty amazing. I've gotten to do a couple events where he's there, and I was hosting, and I had to talk with him and then introduce him and got to pray over him and stuff. And he's filled with such joy despite the fact that he has such a huge, you know, burden in his life. But when I was born, you know, no one knew that there was these birth defects, and I didn't look like I had any birth defects. I was born, I had all my fingers, my hands, my arms, my toes, whatever. I was all there, and everything was fine. I was born, I was like 8 pounds, and in one day, I lost 50% of my birth weight. So I went from 8 pounds to 4 pounds in one day, right? So the second day of my life, they were like, okay, we're pretty concerned, because I kept spitting up everything. So everything they tried to feed me, my mom tried to feed me, they tried to give me special formulas, whatever, and I would just spit everything up. And nothing was basically digesting. And I was just losing weight. So they started doing all these medical tests on me. Now, obviously, medicine has advanced a long, long way since then, but they did what they could. And they came back to my parents at the end of the second day of my life, and they said, well, we've discovered an issue. Your son actually was born with a birth defect. And my mom was like, God bless you. My mom was like, where? We don't see anything wrong. And they said, it's actually internal. And my mom was like, what kind of birth defect can be internal? And they said, well, we all have a large intestine and a small intestine, right? And the small intestine is the one that's really long and all squiggly in the middle of us, right? Well, I was born with a twist, with a knot, a twisted knot in my intestine. And they said, basically what's happening is that his food is starting to be digested, and then it's getting stopped and backed up at the knot, and then it's all coming back up. And so your son is not being able to digest any food. And this is basically a fatal condition. Like he's going to die. He's going to starve to death. Okay. And of course, that was very devastating news to my parents, right? I was their first child. They'd had a miscarriage before me. I was the first child to be born, and my mom's the oldest of nine, and she was the first one. I was going to be the first grandchild on my mom's side of the family. Everybody's very excited, and you get this fatal diagnosis, basically. So my parents were sad. They said, well, we can do one thing, right? We can attempt to do this very risky surgery where what we're going to do is we're going to cut open your son's stomach from his belly button to his side, and we're going to pull out his small intestine, okay, and basically lay it on a table while it's still hooked to him. And we're going to cut out the knot, right? We're going to try to find the knot, cut it out, and we're going to sew the other two ends back together, and we're going to hope that it works. And my parents said, I mean, is there anything else you can do? And they said, that's the only chance we have. And they said, okay, then do it. And they said, well, we have to warn you, though. Even doing the surgery, we still predict that your son has a 95% chance of dying, right? 95% chance of dying. You know, last week I was in Orlando doing a retreat, and I had to fly back from Orlando to Baltimore to get to my house. And if I had gone to the gate area, right, where I was going to get on my plane, and the gate agent got on and was like, Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Orlando International Airport, Flight 773, departing to Baltimore, Washington International. One quick announcement. The pilot has just informed me that there is a 95% chance that this plane is going to crash. Welcome aboard. Okay, I'm not getting on that plane. I don't know about you, but I'll be like, I'll wait for the plane that has a 95% chance of landing. I'm not going to get on the plane that has a 95% chance of crashing, okay? Like, that's crazy. So if someone's giving you a 95% chance of dying, right, you're going to be like, okay, I guess I'm going to die. So, in fact, there was two other babies in the 2 months that I was in the hospital. My mom said they came in and had the same birth defect, had the same surgery, and both of those other babies died, okay? So, obviously, I didn't. And that's why this picture is a miracle, because this picture shouldn't have taken. I mean, really, I should have died when I was 3 or 4 days old, okay? So from the time that I was very young, this question that I had on the first slide, right, this question of who am I, okay? I kind of like had answers to that. From the earliest of my memories, I could remember my mom telling me about this story and how I was, I had this surgery, right? And you might say, why would your mom tell you that? Well, I have a big scar that goes from here to here across my stomach. I would show it to you, but then you'd be scarred, okay? So, but trust me, it's there, okay? And so when you're a little kid, you're like, what's that on my belly? You know, and like you get other kids looking at you like, what's wrong with him? You know, and I used to be embarrassed of it actually when I was little. I used to make up stories. I'd be like, I was in a knife fight. They're like, you're eight. no, you weren't. Then I'd be like, I was attacked by a shark. They're like, it would be looking worse than that if you were attacked by a shark, right? So the point is that I had this surgery. I survived. I lived. And from the earliest of my memories, I knew that there must be a reason why I'm here. And my mom had always said, you're a miracle baby. You're a miracle child, right? You know, God could have taken you and he left you here. There must be some reason why you're here. And you just have to know that you're a son of God. You're a child of God. And God will show you. God will tell you what your purpose is in this life. At some point, he will reveal that to you. And because I was little and I knew my mom and my dad loved me, I just believed what they said, because that's what we do when we're little. We believe our moms and dads and they tell us stuff. And we go to First Communion rehearsal and we go to First Communion catechetical training and learning about our First Communion, right? And they say, Jesus loves you. And we say, Jesus, L-U-V, loves me, right? And we make little collages and stuff. And we just believe that Jesus loves us until things start to change a little bit, okay? But I want to ask you this question, because I don't want to just talk about me. I want you to think about yourself as I'm talking, right? And I want you to ask another question, right? Again, I'm so glad Deacon Randy brought up questions. What's this initial question? Like, why were you created, right? Like, why did God even create you, right? Somebody asked a difficult question earlier. We had all these kind of weird questions and shout outs and funny, silly things. And then someone asked that question of how come I'm ugly, right? And that kind of thing. And I think you'll see whoever that was as we go through my story today, I can relate to that, right? But we have to start with why were we even created in the first place, okay? It goes back before we get to that point where we start thinking, I'm ugly, or I'm dumb, or I'm stupid, or I'm not talented enough, or I'm not good enough, or I'm not funny enough, or whatever you're not enough of that you think you're not enough of, right? Because those are the voices that we start to hear. You know, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, big, huge, thick book. I know some of you have probably seen it. Some of you have probably had to read some of it. It has 2,865 paragraphs, okay? Paragraphs. That's a lot of paragraphs. It's a big, huge book. It's a reference book. In that book is basically everything that we believe as Catholics. Everything about morality, prayer, liturgy, what the church teaches on what we believe about God and Mary, and everything is in there, okay? And there's a lot of people that know all sorts of parts of the Catechism. Some people have parts memorized. Some people, like if they're studying a certain thing or they're teaching a certain thing, they have big chunks of it that are memorized or really studied, and they go through that. And I like to go around and ask people and say, what does the very first paragraph of the Catechism say? And people are kind of like, you know what? I don't know. Right? You know, we were talking about To Kill a Mockingbird earlier. I don't know how many of you like to read, whether it's that book or another book, right? But if you like to read, you know that when you read a novel or a book, right, in the very first paragraph of the book, normally something really important, there's important information given to you, right? Like you're introduced to a character, or you are introduced to a scene or a town or a city, or someone gets murdered, or, you know, something happens in the first paragraph that sets something big up for later on in the book, okay? And the same thing happens in To Kill a Mockingbird, right? That first paragraph, like, just draws you in, okay? What does the first paragraph of the catechism say, right? And here's why I want to focus on this for a minute before I go back to the specifics of my story. I want to be really clear about this. 2,865 paragraphs, okay? If you don't understand and know what the first paragraph of the Catechism of the Catholic Church says, the other 2,864 paragraphs don't make any sense. They don't make any sense. Without the first paragraph, the rest of the paragraphs simply become rules and regulations and definitions, and they seem to be disconnected from our life, okay? So I want to really focus on what this first paragraph says, okay? So I've broken it down into two parts, okay? So it says this, the very first words here in the first paragraph of the Catechism, God, infinitely blessed and perfect in himself, in a plan of sheer goodness, freely created man to make him share in his own blessed life, okay? So what is that first sentence? God, infinitely perfect and blessed in himself. What does that mean? That means God does not need you. God does not need me. You're like, wow, that's really humbling. Yes. Yes, it is. God does not need you. God does not need me, right? God wasn't sitting up in heaven all of a sudden going like, I could really use a soulmate, right? God wasn't somehow bored up in heaven all of a sudden like, you know what, let's create some people and then they'll make Netflix and then we'll have something to do in the evenings, right? Like, no, God was completely perfect and blessed in himself. God had no needs. God did not need, he was lacking in nothing. God did not need you. God did not create you because he needed you. God did not create Scott Anthony because he needed Scott Anthony. God does not even need Scott Anthony to be giving this talk right now. Doesn't matter. Anybody else could be giving a talk and could be maybe even doing a better job. Okay? But that's the first thing. The first thing the catechism says is we should be humble because God doesn't need us. But what's the next part? Well, if God doesn't need us, then why did he create us? God doesn't need us. This is mind-blowing when you really think about it. God doesn't need you, but God wants you. God doesn't need you, but he wants you. And everybody wants to be wanted. You just do. You know, don't think perverted when I say that, right? I just mean in the deepest heart of our hearts, we want to be seen, we want to be noticed, we want to be wanted. We want people to, you know, I remember when I was in ninth grade, I'm moving ahead to my story, but my mom would say like, I think you're handsome. Like, who the crap cares if your mom thinks you're handsome when you're in ninth grade? I wanted that cute girl in my math class to think I was handsome in ninth grade. What am I going to do in ninth grade? Take my mom to homecoming? Right? Like, what, people are like, oh, you brought your mom to homecoming? I mean, what do you have to say back if someone rips on you when you bring your mom to homecoming? Like, shut up, she drives? I mean, like, okay, like you don't have anything back, right? As you start to get older, you want to know that people are choosing to love you, choosing to like you, choosing to want to be with you, not because they have to be, not because you were just born into that family, right? We want to know that we're wanted. And the catechism tells us right from the very beginning, God doesn't need us, but God wants us. God, who created literally everything in the universe, wanted you. And the universe, he decided, was not complete if you weren't part of it. That's an amazing thought to think about. So why did God want you? Why did God want to create you? Okay. Freely created us, men and women, right? To make us share in his own blessed life. What is the blessed life of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? It is perfect love. God created you because he wanted to simply share his love. He didn't have a need. He's perfectly loved within himself. Father, Son, and Spirit. But he wants to share his love. So he created you and he created me. He goes on to say in the catechism, for this reason, at every time and at every place, even an early morning marad's in when you're tired, right? At every time and every place, even when you're in sin, at every time and at every place, even if you're on a mandatory retreat, even if you're in church and you want to just zone out because the homily's terrible or your parents are making you, at every time and in every place, God draws close to man. He calls man to seek him, to know him, to love him with all his strength. At every time and at every place, God is drawing close to us. Think about that for a minute. We somehow think that we have to reach God. I was doing a retreat in August down in North Carolina, and this priest was giving this homily. And it was a great homily. It was the scripture reading, the gospel reading about the Samaritan woman that's sitting at the feet of Jesus at the table, and he's reclining, he's eating right dinner with the Pharisees or whatever. And she's like, Lord, you know, can you help me? And it seems like Jesus is ignoring her, right? It seems like Jesus is like, what's wrong with Jesus in this, you know, scripture? And then, you know, he says like, you know, something like dismissive to her. And she says, Lord, even the dog gets scraps from the master's table. And he's like, whoa, look at the faith of this woman, right? And the priest was using this as an example of like how much like higher, you know, he was saying like the Jews were up here and the Samaritans were down here. Plus she was a woman. And in that culture, you know, like if you're a Samaritan woman, that's like two strikes against you and whatever. And how, you know, like God is so much higher than us, more than the Jews were above the Samaritans, more than a man was above a woman at the time. And he's going on and on and on about how God is so far up out of our reach. He's so far beyond what we can understand and comprehend and grasp, right? And we're so far down here. And I'm like, yes, this is all true. We need to know this. We need to know that, you know, that God is not tame and he's wild and he's so far up there and we can't do anything to reach him. And I'm waiting for Father, I'm not trying to be critical of a priest, but I'm waiting for him to give the best part of this story. And he just ends the homily there and walks off. And I'm like feeling depressed. And I was depressed for all the kids that I was on the retreat with that heard this message and it ended there. I was like, yes, that's true. God's way up there and we're down here. But that's depressing. What's the good news of that? There's nothing exciting about that. Oh, great. I believe in God. He's up there and I'm down here and I can never reach him. I would walk away from a religion that taught that. That's not what our church ends at. The beauty is that God knew he's up here and we're down here and we can't reach him. So what did our God do? He came down to us. He lowered himself to our level so that he could raise us up to him. And so at every time and at every place, God draws close to man. Even when we're in the middle of sin, God is drawing close to us. Even when we're running away from him, he's chasing after us and he's calling out to us and he calls us to seek him, to know him, to love him with all his strength, right? And guys, whether you know it or not, you're seeking God at every moment. When you're trying to, you know, be the best you can be on the theater stage, playing soccer, you know, doing your best in your studies, trying to get good grades, all these kinds of, like we're seeking God. Our ultimate fulfillment in this life cannot come from anything in this world. Our hearts were not created for this world. Our hearts can only be satisfied by God. And that's why we are seeking him, whether we know it or not. And he is constantly knocking on the door of our heart, inviting us to open that door so that he can come in. And he won't come in unless we invite him in. He's going to stand there and he's going to knock and he's going to knock and he's going to knock and he's going to knock. He'll do it our entire lives. But if we don't say yes and open the door, he's not going to barge his way in. But he wants us to seek him and he wants us to know him, not just know about him. I mean, it's great to know our faith. You know, if people ask us questions, 1 Peter says, be ready to give a reason for the hope that is within you to anyone who asks. Right? So we should be ready. That's why I said, have a testimony ready. Why are you so joyful? Why do you go to church? Why are you still Catholic with all those scandals that have happened? How on earth could you be? I mean, that can't be the real church. Why are you Catholic? People aren't going to listen to up here. They're going to listen to here. Right? And to know him, there's a difference between knowing about Jesus and knowing Jesus. People that are atheists can know all about Jesus, right? They can study the Bible. They can read the catechism. It's available to anybody who wants to read it. There's a difference between here and here. And a lot of us grow up Catholic and we go to Catholic school and we go to religious ed programs and we learn all about Jesus up in here. And I'm not saying it's bad, but even Pope John Paul II, St. Pope John Paul the Great, said that the definitive aim of catechesis, right? The whole point of teaching someone about the faith is so that we can come to have an intimate, his words, intimate relationship with Jesus Christ. As you sit here today, do you have an intimate relationship with Jesus Christ? Is Jesus your best friend? Have you opened the door of your heart to him and let him come in? Because he doesn't want you to just know about him. He wants you to know him. And why is this important? Again, going back to when you're going and you're receiving your first communion and your teachers and your parents just tell you all about Jesus. And you're like, Jesus loves me. I'm going to go receive Jesus. And it's so special. I don't understand it at all, but I don't understand anything because I'm 7. And so I just believe it with all my heart. And then what happens is that you get older and life starts hitting you, doesn't it? People start making fun of you. Somebody you love passes away. Somebody gets sick. Life gets difficult. You have to move to another town and try to make friends. You get disappointed. And when life starts hitting you, where does life hit you? Point to where life hits you. This is where life hits you. Life doesn't hit you here. Life hits you here. And if your faith is only here, what do you think is going to happen to your faith life when life hits you here? It's going to be gone. Because if you're someone who believes in God and bad stuff starts happening in your life, there's only two responses. There's only two ways you can react to that. You can either get angry with God, blame God, question God, yell at God, and turn from God, or you just fall deeper into God. That's what I've done in my life as an adult when there's been tragedy. At this point, it's just like, Jesus, I don't understand what's going on here. I don't know why this is so difficult, but I'm just going to go deeper into you because I have no other recourse. Right? But if your faith has been only formed here your whole life and life starts hitting you, many times, and again, I've worked 26 years with young people, many times they had a faith, but it was here. And life starts hitting them and they just, it just goes away. Jesus doesn't want you to just know about him. He wants you to know. Isn't it interesting that the very first paragraph of an entire book to help you know about God tells you in the very first paragraph that the most important thing is to know him, not know about him? See, if you understand this first paragraph, that you were created because God wanted to show you his love, that God wanted you to experience his love, that God wanted you to be in relationship with him, ultimately so that you could be with him forever in heaven, then the rest of the catechism makes sense because then he's revealing his heart to you. If you don't understand this, then you just think God's revealing his mind to you. And you don't have a relationship with someone's mind. You have a relationship with someone's heart, right? So I didn't know all that fancy stuff that I just talked about, right, when I was younger. I knew it here, right? I didn't really know it here. But, you know, here's the thing. Everything was fine until fifth grade. And then in fifth grade, something happened. Now, I know you're looking at a picture and you're thinking, well, you used to be pretty cute in fifth grade. I know I was. My hair, not so much. But I do remember very clearly that day going to school and deciding that was the day I was going to try to change my hairdo. And I didn't have a comb or a brush. I basically just had my hand and my spit. And I just tried to do that. And that's what came up. But what you can see from that picture is that I'm a happy kid. I'm just a happy, normal kid. I'm smiling. It's genuine. You see a sparkle in my eye. You can see that I'm kind of like the skinny kid, which you couldn't see that I was always the short kid, right? I was always the shortest kid in my class. So I grew up, I was always this short little skinny kid. You go to the doctors when you're growing up, they always take your height and your weight and they plot it on this like graph in your chart. And it's a height, weight, growth chart. And they always tell you like what percentile you are. You know, oh, I'm 50th percentile in this and I'm 70th percentile. I was only like fifth percentile for height and weight. So I was always the skinniest, shortest kid in my class. And then in fifth grade, the end of fifth grade, I completely stopped growing. We didn't realize that at the time, but 3 years went by. And in eighth grade, I'm the same height that I was in fifth grade, which was 4'7". Just to put it in perspective, if I was standing next to me now, it would be about here. So when I get into eighth grade, I was 4'7". So here's a picture of me in eighth grade. I'm the short kid in the middle. The nun on my right, or my left, to our right, is my teacher. She's an adult. That's not my sponsor. That's a girl in my class. The guy behind us is in my class. I'm actually older than both of them. Okay? This was in Warrenton, Virginia. I grew up in Northern Virginia, first grade to ninth grade there. Right? And I went to a small Catholic grade school, probably only about 12 to 16 people in my class any given year after maybe third or fourth grade. Okay? And I don't think people are trying to be mean in middle school. I think middle school can just be a really awkward time because, you know, your bodies are changing and your emotions and your hormones and everything is going crazy. And some people are like in seventh grade and look like they're 18 and some people still look like they're 8, right? And it's so weird. And I think people are just kind of like, what's going on? Like, we're all growing and stuff and Scott isn't. So I don't think people were trying to be mean, but some people started teasing me. They started saying things to me, right? And what happened is as I went through middle school and I just stopped growing, my weight kept going normal, right? When I was this age, when I was 13, 14 years old in eighth grade, I was actually the 50th percentile for weight. I was the perfect weight for an eighth grade boy. The problem was, is I was the height of a short fifth grader. And so I went from being the shortest, skinniest kid in my class to being abnormally short and heavy in like a year and a half. Right. And people started teasing me. They started teasing me about the way that I looked. I got glasses at the end of fifth grade. So all of a sudden I have glasses. You can tell that my face is rounder here, that I put on weight. I'm super, super short compared to everybody. I mean, they're literally head and shoulders taller than me. And by the time I got to eighth grade, I don't know if you can see this in this picture, but I mean, I go back to the picture in fifth grade where I look very genuine and I'm smiling and I'm happy. And I go to eighth grade and that is such a fake smile. It's unbelievable. I'm just kind of like, okay, take a picture. Let's move on. This was actually at my confirmation, after my confirmation mass. When I was in eighth grade, I hated myself. I literally hated myself. I hated the way that I looked. When I looked in the mirror, what I saw were their voices. Does that make sense? What I saw were the voices, the things, the words that people had told me for 2 or 3 years. I saw those voices when I looked in the mirror. I started to forget who I was. I started to listen to those things and I started to see those things in the mirror. Instead of seeing a child of God, I started to see someone who was broken and wounded, right? In seventh grade, they introduced a new subject at school. Some people call it algebra. I call it hell. Anybody with me? All right. Thank you. I was like, wanted to form a petition that said, let's keep letters in English class where they belong. Right. I had no idea why we're bringing letters in the math class. I'm like, I had no idea what was going on. And all of a sudden, not only do I feel ugly, now I feel stupid. And once you start feeling stupid, you know what you do? You just give up. So I just stopped trying in all my classes and I just became the class clown. And I was like, well, I'm just going to laugh it all off because it's better to have people laughing with you than people laughing at you. But you somehow have this idea in the back of your brain that they're still laughing at you, even though you're trying to be the class clown. In eighth grade, the doctors finally said, we need to find out what's going on with this kid, right? We got to do some tests, right? So in eighth grade, I had to go to Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and they were going to do a 5-hour blood test where every 20 and 40 minutes they were going to draw blood. How many people don't like needles? Okay, so you're not going to like this story, all right? The needle wasn't the worst part. They didn't stick a new needle in me every 20 and 40 minutes. That would have, like, been torturous. What they did is they put an IV. They tried to find a good vein on the back of my hand or down here. They couldn't find one. As it turns out, I have this, like, uber vein right here in my Krelbo. Now, my wife and I came up with the term Krelbo because there's actually no official name for this part of your body, and I thought elbow pit sounded awkward, so we came up with Krelbo, okay? And, you know, if you guys could use that as much as possible, it'll eventually get in the dictionary, okay? I want credit for that, but, you know, like, how you could use that in a sentence. Someone throws you the microphone, and you're like, whoa. It's okay. I just caught it with my Krelbo, okay? So that's a word with the sentence, how you can use it, okay? So, in fact, this is like this uber vein. I still give blood to the American Red Cross, and they're always like really excited about this. Anybody want to touch it? Seriously, it's really cool. All right, AJ? Yeah. It's like a trampoline for your finger. It's like right there. It actually has a shadow. You're like right there. You feel it? Yeah. It's pretty cool. Anybody else? No? Okay, later on, you can. It's pretty cool. Anyway, so they put the IV right there in my Krelbo, okay? And the nurse tapes it down, right? And then she takes a step back. I'm sitting in this hospital bed. She takes a step back to kind of look at her handiwork, and she goes, Now, I'm no medical professional, okay? But I'm pretty sure you should get all the hmms out of the way before you stick a needle in my Krelbo. I was like, what? She's like, well, now that I have it in there, I'm just a little concerned that at some point in the next 5 hours, you might accidentally go like this, and that would mess up the test and probably hurt, you know? And I was like, yeah? And she's like, okay, hold still. I'll be back in a minute. So I'm like, oh my gosh. I was a little dramatic, okay? So I'm like sitting there thinking I'm going to die. She comes back in the room like 8 minutes later, okay? I kid you not. She is holding in her hands a 2x4, okay? If you don't know what a 2x4 is, it's a piece of wood that like they used to like make walls out of, right? So these are like little mini 2x4s over here in that side section there. But you're in your house, in the cabins, you know, the walls, they build the cabins. Those are 2x4s, okay? She comes in with a 2x4 about this long, right? About 4.5 feet long. And she goes in the, I'm like, what is she doing with the 2x4? She goes in the bathroom. She comes out. She's wrapping a towel around the 2x4. Then she comes over to me, pulls my arm up, sticks the 2x4 under my arm, and starts to tape my arm to this piece of lumber, okay? And I'm looking at her like, what the heck are you doing, you know? Now, you might say to yourself, Scott, you big wimp, right? Like, if you stuck your arm out like this, it wouldn't hurt that bad, okay? Do it for 5 hours, okay? Your arm was not intended to be like this for 5 hours, or God would not have invented the elbow, okay? That's not in the Bible, but I know it's true, okay? So my arm is getting table ass. Anybody ever had like a Charlie horse muscle cramp in your calf? You're running down the soccer field or the basketball court or something, all of a sudden you're just like, ah! You know, like go falling on the ground, and you're writhing around like you're dying until somebody flips you on your back and bends your leg back, and you're like, oh, that's magically delicious. And all of a sudden, like, it feels all better, okay? Well, that's awesome when it's in your calf. You can't do that when it's in your arm and your arm is taped to a 2x4, okay? Like, your arm's just stuck. So that was pretty bad, right? I had my arm taped there. I mean, there were times it was like my muscles are throbbing, contracting. There's like Charlie horses. Can't do anything about it. It's pretty painful, okay? That wasn't the worst thing, right? And then after she gets me all hooked up to this thing, right, she takes a step back and she goes, by the way, okay, again, I am no medical professional, but I think we should get all the oh, by the ways out of the way before you tape my arm to a 2x4, okay? And she's like, you see that machine next to you? And I look and I'm like, yes. She's like, you're hooked up to it. I said, what does that mean? She goes, well, a couple of things. One, there's going to be dyes and chemicals we have to put in your bloodstream before we take the blood. So that's going to automatically do that. The other thing is that this machine doesn't move, so you're kind of stuck here. And also, we need your heart at a resting rate. So basically what it means is you'd have to lay as still as possible in this bed for the next 5 hours, okay? Now, again, some of you might not find that so bad, but like when you were like, think back to when you were like a 13-year-old boy, especially the guys, because it would be hard for the girls. But think back, guys, when you were like a 13-year-old boy, and like the plane of your existence is normally lived somewhere around here. Okay, like that's basically every 13-year-old boy, okay? And so being asked to like lay still as possible in this bed for 5 hours was basically like purgatory. I'm pretty sure I got time off purgatory laying there in that bed, okay? But that wasn't even the worst part. About two and a half hours into the test, worst thing ever. Can anyone guess? I had to pee. Yep, I had to pee. And I was sitting there, and my mom was there with me. Now, my mom is a nurse, but she wasn't being my nurse. She was just being my mom, right? So I said, hey, Mom, can you call the nurse for a minute? And she goes, sure. She's walking over to the call button, and she stops. She goes, well, sweetie, maybe there's something I can help you with because the nurse might be busy with other people. I said, no. I said, I just need the nurse. I said, I just need her to unhook me real quick. I'm going to hop out of bed, jump in the bathroom. I'm going to pee. I'm going to get back into bed. She can hook me back up. It'll take like less than a minute. My mom looks at me, and she says, sweetie, they're not going to unhook you. I said, ha, you're funny, deaf woman. I said, I have to pee. And she's like, I heard you, but I'm telling you, they are not going to unhook you. I looked at my mom. I said, how am I going to pee if they don't unhook me? And my mom looked at me like totally serious. Like this was like a normal conversation. She's like, well, there's a little bowl called a bedpan, and we're going to come and just like put it on the side of the bed, and you're going to lay on your side. You'll pee in the bowl, and then we'll go flush it. Now, how many of you want to go home and pee in a bowl while your mommy holds it, okay? I was like, no, I'm not peeing in a bowl while you hold it, right? I'm not doing that, okay? I'm not doing that. And I was like, well, because then, yo, here's the thing. I started thinking the next logical question, right? Because I'm thinking, how am I going to be? I'm like, remember, my arm's taped to a board. I'm thinking to myself, how am I supposed to hold the bowl and aim with one good hand, right? Because this arm's taped out here like this. That's not working. Yeah, that's what my mom said. I'll hold it. I was like, no, you're not holding the bowl. There's got to be another option. She said the nurse can do it. I said, I'm not peeing in a bowl while someone holds it. She said, okay, those are the options. I said, you know what? Mind over matter. I'm going to hold it. I don't have to go. I just convinced myself. And I'm here 34, 35 years later to tell you, I held it. I know. Some of you want to applaud, but hold on that applause. Hold on. I held it for 40 minutes. Okay. And then I had to pee so bad. It's like the urine was seeping out the pores of my face. It was so bad. I was like, right. And then you're faced with two things. One, I'm going to be embarrassed either way, okay? But I'm either going to pee in a bowl while someone holds it, and that's going to be embarrassing, or I'm going to pee all over this bed. And then they're going to have to change me, and that's going to be more embarrassing. So I was like, fine, get the nurse. So my mom gets a nurse. The nurse comes over, and this is what the nurse does. And I'm not kidding or exaggerating. The nurse holds this bowl. She comes over. I'm trying to get on my side. She holds the bowl. She turns a little bit, I guess, to give me some privacy, okay? And she goes like this. Don't worry, sweetie. Don't be embarrassed. I do this all the time. Just relax, you know? And I looked at her. I said, ma'am, if you don't hold that bowl still we're going to have a major problem, okay? Because I can barely hit a stationary target, let alone one that's moving, okay? And if you're at home, girls, and you got, like, brothers or dads or whatever, you like, you understand what I'm talking about. I mean, girls don't want to use men's rooms. I mean, like, girls, you God made you. You sit. It goes where it's supposed to go, right? Guys are up there, and sometimes we're like, whoa, how'd that happen? I'm just telling you, right? The guys are all like, yeah, that's so true. It's like one of those questions you're going to ask God when you get to heaven, like, hey, God, that's going to be in the question for tomorrow. I Kelly, somebody funny guy is going to put that in the question box tomorrow.
Alumni crew, how come when you pee as a guy, your pee goes sideways sometimes?
I don't know. I'm going to ask God that question. But the thing is that, anyway, very embarrassing. Get through that story. Get through that time of my life. Do a ton of these medical tests all year long. And they end up sitting me down at the end of eighth grade, and they said, well, we have some bad news and we have some good news, right? The bad news is that you have another birth defect. And they found out that I had another internal birth defect. We all have this gland on the back underside of our brain called the pituitary gland. And they basically looked at me and they said, yours doesn't work. I said, what does that mean? They said, well, in and of itself, what it means is not only will you not grow anymore, you're also not going to go through puberty. Now, there's a lot of things that a 14-year-old boy does not want to hear. I could tell you from personal experience at the top of the list is you're going to be a man child for the rest of your life, right? Because I'm looking at this going, okay, my life is now over, right? And they said, no, but we have good news, right? We can give you something called growth hormone shots. And I was like, oh, like shots? And they're like, no, you're 14. No, like shots, like with a needle. And I'm like, oh, great. So all 4 years of high school, 3 times a week, I had to take growth hormone shots, right? And I started in ninth grade. But when I got into ninth grade, my parents wanted me to go to this Catholic high school. And the closest Catholic high school was about 2 hours away in Fairfax, Virginia. And I had to get on the bus at 5:30 every morning to get home to about 5:15 at night. Literally ninth grade was the worst year of my life. Even though I hated myself by eighth grade, I still believed in God, right? I still believed in God. I still tried to have a relationship with God. In fact, I won the religion award in eighth grade. Thank you. I have no idea what that means. I just got a pin that said religion on it. Okay. But ninth grade came and people went from just teasing me to being mean. Literally in ninth grade, I was abused. I was abused physically. Starting in October that year, there was a kid that got on the bus. We picked up another group of kids halfway to the school, and he would get on the bus. He would walk up and down the aisles until he found me. He would punch me as hard as he could, and he would say, good morning, I hate you. That was every day for the rest of the school year. I got punched in the head, the back, the shoulders, the arms, the legs. He would just punch me as hard as he could, and he'd go sit down. And so what happened is I get into ninth grade, and I didn't realize I'm still growing. That's actually me on our far right, right? Those are my two younger brothers, okay? And this picture says a couple things. One, you get the brick. So you can see my brother, Brian, is on the far left. He's in sixth grade in this picture. I'm in ninth grade in this picture. You can see he's a whole head taller than me. My brother, Chris, is in the middle, who comes up to my eyebrows. Chris is in third grade. I'm in ninth grade, right? You can look at their faces. They're like, yay, it's picture time. This is so exciting. And you look at my face and I'm like, I'm going to kill you, right? There's darkness. I'm not smiling. Look at my body language. I'm like hiding behind my brother. I'm putting my arm across my stomach because I'm embarrassed of my weight. I'm embarrassed how I looked. I had these big old glasses. My shirt, like, what the heck is my shirt unbuttoned down to the middle of my chest for? It's untucked. I mean, it's like, I look a mess. But you know what? I look at that picture and I'm like, that picture represents, I was a mess. My entire life was a mess, right? And so I'm taking these growth hormone shots, get through ninth grade. And between ninth grade and 10th grade, my parents moved from Virginia to a little town on the Ohio River called Steubenville, which is just down the street here, about 15 minutes. And I ended up going to Catholic Central High School in Steubenville, Ohio. I made a pledge to myself that summer. I didn't want to be miserable anymore. I was completely miserable. I hated myself. I hated everybody else. And I didn't stop believing in God. I think I did something worse. By the end of ninth grade, I stopped believing that God loved me. I mean, God might be there. He might love other people, but he doesn't love Scott Anthony. And I made a pledge to myself that I was just not going to be miserable anymore. I made a pledge that I'm going to be one of those popular people in my school. Everybody's going to know who I am. I'm going to be funny. I'm going to have friends. You grow the most that first year, taking growth hormone shots. So when I started school sophomore year, I was 5'1", which isn't super tall. But when you've been 4'7 for 3 years or 4 years, going to 5'1 in 1 year from 4'7 is pretty good. My weight stayed the same, so I thinned out as I grew taller. I ended up trying out for the soccer team. I made the soccer team, and I threw myself into activities. I still stayed the class clown. I loved to make people laugh. I had a story here called the Spanish story that I do not have time to tell you, but maybe later if you see me, I can tell you the Spanish story. And I went through, and by the time I was a senior in high school, I'd achieved everything I wanted to achieve. And that's my, God bless you, that's my high school graduation picture, and that's my friend Lynn. I wasn't dating or anything. Her family, that was the same girl from eighth grade picture there next to it. I just put that there so you could see that I grew, you know, a lot between those two pictures. When we moved from Virginia to Ohio, her family moved from Virginia to New Jersey, but we stayed family friends, and they were nice enough to come out for my graduation, right? But I want to fast forward here to one thing. That's my senior photo, actually. And I was actually voted the best actor of my class, right? Catholic Central High School in 1989. And I'm looking at the picture. And the problem is that picture is I'd achieved everything I wanted by senior year, right? I was pretty popular. I had a ton of friends, hung out with people, played on the soccer team, starting outside left midfielder. I was in the plays and musicals. I had leading roles in some of those. I was involved in the newspaper and the yearbook because I could make people look good or I could make them look bad. They all wanted to be my friends so I could write good, funny things about them. And for all intents and purposes out here, Scott Anthony was fine. Scott Anthony was happy. Scott Anthony was doing great. But this picture tells a different story when I look at it. Because middle of the year, I turn 18 years old, and I'm literally crying myself to sleep every night. Because nothing's more miserable than thinking I just need to achieve A, B, C, and D, and you work really hard to achieve it, and you're still miserable. Because what I started doing sophomore year was basically putting on masks. And some of you understand what I'm talking about. You get up in the morning before school, you get a shower, you get dressed, you put on your shoes, you put on your backpack, and right as you walk out the door, you put on your mask. And you go to school and you wear your mask. And maybe you wear one mask, maybe you wear 100 different masks. But what you let people see out here is very different than what's actually going on in here. And I did that for 3 years. And maybe some of you have experienced the same thing that I've experienced when I did that for 3 years of my life, is that it's exhausting. It's exhausting. And I'm looking at this senior picture. I'm not smiling. My eyes are just as dark and black as the other picture from ninth grade. But if I go back to this high school graduation picture, I'm looking at myself in that picture and I say, wow, look at me. I'm like genuinely smiling. I like look genuinely happy, right? Like I'm not faking it. I'm not looking terrible. I'm not looking fake as I did in eighth grade. That's a genuine smile. When I, several years ago, put together some pictures for this slideshow, that picture in fifth grade, I couldn't find another picture until that picture of my graduation where I thought I'm actually sincerely smiling and look happy and I don't look angry or I don't look fake. I couldn't find another picture. And I think the reason why that picture is there and I look that way is because that picture is another miracle. That was taken the last weekend of May 1989, the last weekend of April 1989, I tried to commit suicide. And I'm not going to go into the details of that because they're not really important. God miraculously saved me for a second time in my life. I probably didn't deserve that, but that's why God is merciful. We don't deserve it. And I don't think everything was put together in my life, but I think I realized afterwards that, you know, life is precious. I think I realized that something important was missing in my life. And I think that's why that picture finally shows me with this kind of freedom, right? But, you know, I was scared in those first few weeks afterwards. I was scared and I was lonely and I was so confused. I was in a very, very dark place for so many years. And maybe some of you have been in that dark place. I certainly know that the person who wrote that question about feeling ugly is in a dark place right now. And so I just want to end by just sharing. And this is how this really relates back to you. And maybe this won't be you. Maybe it's not you. Maybe it's a friend. But there are times in life where we will be in dark times. We will be at times when, I mean, you might, and it doesn't matter how close you are to Jesus, right? Like you can be like really, really close to Jesus and you can still fall into a dark time, right? Peter was right next to Jesus after he walked across the water when he started to sink because he called out to Jesus and Jesus just reached out his hand and grabbed him. Peter walked all that way from the boat right next to Jesus before he started to sink. So this has nothing to do with how close you are to God or not, but you can be really close to God or far away from God and you can go into a dark place where you're consumed with dark thoughts. You're consumed with dark emotions and dark feelings and you start to think there's no way out because in those dark places, that's when Satan starts to lie to you, right? And he starts to say things to you that aren't true. And maybe Maybe this has happened to you. Maybe it hasn't happened to you. Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. Maybe you're going to encounter friends that they're in a dark place. I'm sure every single one of you in here has a friend who's either been in a dark place or is in a dark place right now. And when we're in that dark place, we start to listen to the lies of Satan. We start to believe that there's nothing better. Life is going to stay like this. There's no hope. This is all that life is ever going to be. We feel trapped. We can fall into despair. And I just want to encourage you guys as we get near to ending here, right, that there is hope and there is more. God is not done writing the story of your life. He's just not done. He's not done. You're sitting in here, you're 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. God is not done with the story of your life. And there's so much more he wants to write with the story of your life that you can't even imagine, right? I get off to college and went to Franciscan University by the grace of God. Don't know why I applied there because I wasn't super into God. I went there. God completely changed my world. Sophomore year, I meet this beautiful young freshman because yes, I was checking out the freshman just because I was giving my life to Jesus doesn't mean I had to be a monk. Okay. And so I was like, looking, I found this beautiful woman. We became really good friends doing pro-life ministry together. We ended up falling in love. And a couple years after that, I tricked her into marrying me. Okay. And this past May, we just celebrated 25 years of marriage. I would have never imagined that. Thank you. I would have never imagined that when I was your age. When I was in that darkness, all I could see was the darkness. And God had so much more he wanted to write to my story, right? Thanksgiving, this past Thanksgiving, this is a picture of my family, right? We have 11 children, 3 are in heaven, 8 are on earth. My oldest is 22, all the way down to Lucy, who's 5, right? And life has not been easy. You know, a year and a half ago, my dad passed away from dementia. My little Lucy, who's 5, in October when she was 4, she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which has been very, very difficult with our family. My father-in-law passed away a few years ago. I mean, there's been tragedy and suffering in our lives. When we open our hearts to God and we say, Lord, I'm going to let you write the story of my life, it doesn't mean that everything's going to be perfectly fine and perfectly happy and we're never going to ever have tragedy or ever feel sad again. But you know where we don't go? We don't go into that dark place and listen to Satan anymore. And I look at this and I say to myself too, guys, it's not just about you. And it wasn't just about me. God has more to write in the story of your life, but your life is not your own. I mean, look at this picture. Look at how many other stories God wanted to write with my life. You have no idea the lives that God wants to touch, that God wants to impact, that God may want to create with your life, with your story, right? And the last thing I want to end with here, and I know I'm going really late. We've been late the whole morning, but you don't mind. I know that I asked Grace to have a song ready for me because something that I didn't share last time that really just hit me over the last week is, you know, you guys, if you're, and I'm really, again, some of you may not be in this, but I'm really speaking to the people who are in a dark place right now, okay? If you're in this dark place right now, you know, there's a song that talks about God having reckless love for us. And honestly, it's a song that's very controversial in Christian circles. I don't know if you know this, because there's some people that are like, that's terrible. God's not reckless. God's deliberate. God knows what he's doing or whatever. And I'm like, really? Really? Okay. See, what hit me in the last couple weeks is those boys from Thailand who were stuck in that cave, in that dark place, right? They were stuck in that dark place. And there was over 1,000 rescuers from all over the world risking their lives. A man who lost his life, right, to save them. And they did all the safety precautions they could. They put everything to effect that they could to keep everybody safe and to get those boys out of there safe. But I would argue that if you were one of those rescuers, especially one of those Navy divers, diving through these tunnels that are completely submerged in water, that you have no way of getting out of there. It's murky. It's dark. You're underwater. And you're going back and forth and back and forth for 2 weeks so that you can get these boys out of there. That was reckless. That was reckless on their part. That was reckless heroism, right? They weren't foolish. They weren't stupid. They weren't dumb, but they were reckless. A man lost his life trying to do that. And God lost his life trying to recklessly love you. There is no mountain that God will not climb up, no shadow that he will not shine away. There is no darkness. There is no internal, emotional, spiritual cave that you can be in that God will not be there with you, searching, grabbing. That's what I found out in my own life. And that's what I hope you know in the very depths of your heart is the reckless love that God has for you. I just invite you to close your eyes right now, and we're just going to end listening to the song. And if you know it, feel free to sing as well.